way back on the radio dial, the fire got lit inside a bright-eyed child. Every note just wrapped around his soul, from steel guitars to Memphis, all the way to rock and roll.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. My name is Ryan Ballengee. It's great to have you here with us. We are presented by BetDSI.com. You can get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Ballengee, RyanBallengee. You can email me, Ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com, or check me out on Facebook, facebook.com/golfnewsnet. So last week on the show, we talked about how Jordan Spieth's 2016 really doesn't matter all that much, and in the sense that it doesn't have to be a follow-up to 2015, and that he is, and maybe we should, take a long-term view of his career. And then he goes out and wins the Hyundai Tournament of Champions by 8 shots at 30 under par, becoming just the second player in the history of the PGA Tour to finish a 72-hole tournament at 30 under or better, a shot shy of Ernie Els 12 years ago, who won this tournament at 31 under par, also at Kapalua's Plantation course. So I guess 2016 matters a little bit, but I'm not trying to say that the ideas that we were talking about last week were wrong, that they're inaccurate, and if you didn't listen to them, feel free to take them in, accept them, or reject them. But I still don't think 2016 ultimately matters, but there was an interesting sense in the way that he played, and each round that he played, because the first round he was a shot behind Patrick Reed, and they had been playing together in the first day, because Reed's the defending champion of the tournament that week, and Spieth, as the FedEx Cup champion, got the second slot in the last group, well, the first day, and Reed pulls ahead by a shot, and then Spieth is a shot behind and gets to play with him again, and the next day smokes him and takes pretty much control of the tournament, and then from there it was Spieth's to lose. You know, he went from 3 up to what, 5 up, and then 1 by 8, and I think that, or 4 up, then 5 up, then 8, and it's just remarkable that. It did seem Spieth was motivated each and every round by the notion that if anyone was going to get close to him, he was going to blow him away. And to be truthful, at times he did not play his best golf, but there were certainly a lot of things to look at that he felt like he needed to improve on in the offseason that he did very, very well at Kapalua. And he talked ahead of the tournament about trying to get better inside of 100 yards, 125 yards. He talked about 75 to 100 yards specifically, and those shots looked great, crisp, decisive, good technique, and he converted a lot of those into birdies. And I feel like he didn't have to make as many 25 and 30 footers as maybe we've seen in the past for momentum putts, and part of that is a function of maybe getting a few yards extra off the tee. Kapalua was a bad gauge. We'll find out in Abu Dhabi, and then in the coming weeks, whether that is really all played out as extra distance or not. But it looks like he's maybe a few yards further, maybe a little bit stronger. If he's got a better wedge game, then he has improved as a player. Assuming that the putting more or less stays the same, he should be in store for an incredible year. And he said that after the tournament, he feels his putting is in a place where they could have the Masters the next day, and he would feel really good about his chances to defend the green jacket, becoming just the fourth person in history, if he were to successfully do it, to win back-to-back Masters. And I obviously agree with the sense that he has. The putting was excellent. Lag putting was great. And long iron play was strong. Obviously, the 3-iron that nearly went in for Albatross was pretty incredible, too. And I think you have to walk away nothing but impressed. And what seems even more important than winning by 8 is that everyone thought it was over after 54 at 5. And you could get that sense from Koepka, from Reed, from everybody who was even on the doorstep of contending. And they all pretty much said the same thing. Jordan Spieth has to have a terrible day, and I need to have an incredible day to have a chance to win this golf tournament. And neither of those things materialized. And that is a sense of resignation in the voice of the players in the field. And I don't know if that will become a voice of resignation that becomes more of a constant as Spieth gets into contention, that he will build up a reputation for finishing. He's finished his last four 54-hole leads on the PGA Tour in a row after blowing the first four. So he's figured out how to finish the job. He's figured out how to win. And it seems like he's starting to figure out how to win big and comfortably and without much trouble. And I think that, and you hear that from so many players, playing with a bigger lead, playing where you're trying to kind of balance scoring with basically not trying to shoot yourself in the foot in your path to victory, which should be, at least hypothetically, more assured with more strokes between you and the field, that is a harder skill than holding a close lead, and certainly a harder skill than trying to come from behind and win. And if Spieth is starting to figure out how to do that, then he knows how to win every way. He knows how to come back and win. He knows how to win a close one. He knows how to win in a rout. And if you can win those ways, then you eliminate, not completely, but you eliminate some of the chance of you losing. And I think that makes Spieth so much more lethal, because he is so dedicated to every shot. He is a grinder type guy where he doesn't seem to check out on shots. Seems to check out after the shot because he's talking to the ball, so he's not thinking about where it's, he's thinking about where it's going, but it's, you know, he takes his time off in between shots. He has his conversation with Mike Greller. He talks to the guy that he's playing with, and also not so silently killing, and then he gets over the ball, makes his choice, and executes. And if he can do that and maintain that frame of mind where he has figured out how to selectively focus his time on the golf course on the times that matter, and pull the pressure off of himself a little bit by being a little bit more social, relaxing, walking at the pace that he feels comfortable with, all of those things, then he is figuring out the subtlety to being an all-time great, if he hasn't figured it out already. And that's a little bit frightening, I would think, for guys like Jason Day, who admittedly, obviously, had a second child with his wife Ellie. He had taken more or less the last 2 months off. He had a modest week in coming back, but that's an edge he will have to regain now that he's a dad for a second time. He kind of lost some of that mojo and then sees firsthand what Spieth is accomplishing at Kapalua and goes, oh, no, he didn't stop. Now I've got to get back up there. And if you're McIlroy, who was eligible for this tournament, he won two PGA Tour sanction events last year, is decided not to play. He's going to play Abu Dhabi, which kind of sets the stage for the official kickoff, the unofficial kickoff of the real European Tour season. And I think that's got to be a little bit of a message to McIlroy, too, for him to go, oh, no, this guy is not going to fall back, at least right away. And I think that's just as important as beating the people in the field as the message that it sends to the people who, not necessarily that they weren't in the field, obviously Dave was there, and Fowler was there, but the guys that could be potential challengers to him, what the message it sends other than I beat you is I'm going to keep beating you, and I got better in the offseason. But one guy I really wanted to harp on, and it's because Will Haskett, who is a contributor to our site, golfnewsnet.com, wrote a piece about it, and I've been out of town for the first 3 days of the week, so I didn't record this on the new normal Tuesday or Wednesday schedule. That's why this is a Friday show. But he had sent me a piece while I was away, and I finally got a chance to look at it yesterday, Thursday. And he kind of took a different track than what I was thinking about. But when I read the concept and then read the piece, and you can read it on our site, it makes sense. His theory or his observation was about Patrick Reed, who ultimately finished runner-up with Brant Snedeker, co-runners-up. And that's a good week for Patrick Reed. And I think what you heard from Reed and what you saw from Reed indicates a guy that is as confident as ever. And he's always been an extremely confident player. But I think his confidence now, he feels like he has evolved to the point where he's proven to people with four PGA Tour wins, and what he did in the last 6 weeks, six tournaments leading into the Tournament of Champions, and again did at Kapalua, It's the seventh consecutive world top 10 for him around the world. I mean, he's been in the top 10. He's been a fixture. He went and, after the PGA Tour season, played on the European Tour, played in the final series, didn't finish out of the top 10, added a couple more. I mean, he's now at seven in a row. That's a hell of a streak, and none of those are victories, but it makes him so much more of a threat, I think, because he is consistent. He was kind of flailing about a little bit, and the reputation was going to be that he was going to be a streaky character, that when he won those three times in a 14-month stretch, that all of a sudden he would be this guy that not doesn't win all the time, but just goes and wins three and then goes away. And the fourth win last year at Kapalua was a little validation. Maybe that's not the case, but I think it's more validating for him to go do what he did this year, play in Europe, maintain dual status between the tours, and become a more consistent player. He's made some changes in his game. He's trying to work the ball a little bit more. He's obviously got a hook. He's trying to get a little baby cut. It seems like he feels some confidence with that. And the what he projected and what he was saying after play, ahead of the tournament, all of those things, is that he knows where he is right now. I mean, he knows he is close to being a top five player, going back to being top five Pat. He's in the top 10 in the world, and that is thanks to his consistency. And that, more than anything, is what gets a player into the highest echelons of golf. It isn't winning all the time, although it helps. If you win all the time, then you shouldn't have a problem. But when you go through those stretches where you're not winning and you don't have your best golf, that you feel confident enough that you can play top 10 golf and you can amass world ranking points, you can make money, you can feel like you're carrying some sense of momentum, that if one thing clicks, you can go on the kind of run that he has been on with that three-win stretch in a little over a year, and that he's not trying to project to anybody anymore, at least in this setting, he wasn't trying to project to anybody anymore, that where he thinks he should be. He knows where he should be, and he knows he's not quite at Spieth's level. He knows he's not quite at Day or McIlroy yet. Maybe he thinks he's at McIlroy, and maybe he is. But he knows where he is and where he wants to go, and he feels confident he can get there with the things he's doing because he sees it in the results. And as you find, I think you find this out about a lot of athletes, as they produce the results that to them and their peers indicate that they belong, that they're better, that they're improving, that they're going to get where they're going to go. They kind of pull the hype machine back a little bit and stop worrying about it because the results indicate what's happening. They'll speak for themselves. And I think that Reed, for the first time in his life, is letting the results speak for themselves. He feels secure in his status. He feels secure in what he's accomplished. He feels secure in his acceptance. Whether he's socially awkward or weird or people don't like him, that's almost irrelevant at this point. What Patrick Reed wants more than anything is to be told or believed that he is as good as he says he is, as good as he can be. And he's getting there. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see guys like him, especially because he got out there a little bit ahead of Spieth. He was there around Day and kind of pulled ahead of him, now pulled back, and then you got McIlroy's just his own worldwide animal. But Reed went on to McIlroy's turf in Europe. Well, it wasn't in Europe, but on the European Tour, and showed he can compete with the guy. And I think all of those things make Reed a compelling character. And does that mean, because he can stop worrying about trying to prove something, that he can go out and win a major championship? That he can go out and contend? That his bad play at Augusta National will go away because he knows how to play a golf course like that? One that should favor his game. I mean, he's got the right to left ball flight. He should play well at Augusta National. He hasn't. I think part of that is because he applied pressure to himself. At the U.S. Open, he got himself into contention because he plays the kind of golf that is just aggressive enough that fits a U.S. Open. And then got smoked by Jordan Spieth in that pairing, and that pretty much ended everything. And Spieth went on and got his major again, and Reed is left to stew about what went wrong on that Saturday. And, you know, you kind of... Patrick Reed is a really interesting guy. You may not like him, and I'm not telling you to like him. Quite frankly, I think people that you dislike and respect are more often more interesting than the people that you adore. And because it allows you to see them through a little bit of bias on the negative side, that once you kind of come to respect them, it makes you step back and reassess in a good way. If you fall in love with a Spieth or Day or McIlroy and you think that they can't do anything wrong or that they don't have anything wrong with them and they're just the best ever and they're the friendliest and all those things, and there's no reason not to think that about them. I mean, there's plenty of good reason to like all of those guys. But if you don't look at them critically, then you kind of get in this Spieth swoon where we're at right now, like where we used to be with Tiger or Rory at his best, where just the tweets are just Rory, period, all caps, and go, oh, it's just amazing. It's incredible. They are amazing. But they have flaws. And all of those guys recognize that they have flaws. With Reed, it's pretty freaking apparent what his flaws were, and we were also quick to call him on it. He's trying to address those. I think that that deserves some credit. And I wanted to pass along, if you haven't had a chance to read this, speaking of kind of awkward people, Alan Shipnick did a wonderful profile, and it's a long one for SI. I think it's for SI. It might be for Golf Mag. But it appeared on the web on golf.com this week of Kevin Na. And it's a really interesting look into a guy who is definitely, head case is the wrong word, but not delicate word, but has some psychological issues as it pertains to golf, where his living nightmare is that he can't take the club away, he can't finish the swing, and that he's going to find a way to screw it up. He lives that nightmare, and then he sleeps and dreams about that. And it's just a unforgiving cycle, but he has finally reached a place in his life, the long and short of it, where he doesn't deal with that nightmare part anymore. He's just trying to get over the hump, get another PGA Tour win, and he was second, what, three straight weeks to start the season, and get that win, that second win, and then that can tell him that maybe he can get a major, or at a minimum, get his day at the Players, where 3 years ago, 4 years ago, he got himself into the 54-hole lead, and then in front of a massive audience, kind of lost it. I mean, he lost the lead, but he kind of lost the edge mentally and ultimately suffered a lot of verbal abuse in the hands of fans that day and continues to deal with it, even though he's tried to make strides and the kind of player that he is, the way that he approaches his peers, he's starting to open up out of his shell, kind of like Patrick Reed, and that he is starting to feel more confident in the way that he plays. And the psychological aspect of golf is so much more interesting to me than the physical, because there are so many different types of ways to be good at golf, but the edge that all of those guys have is mental. And it, I mean, talent gives you a mental edge. You go, oh, I hit it further than anybody, that's good, I feel confident. Or I putt it better than everybody else, that's certainly a big piece of confidence. Or I can get out of any situation because of my short game, that's where Phil Mickelson's confidence lies. And you build around that with the components of your game that you build up to get closer to your best talent level. But so the physical has an impact on the psychological, but ultimately, if you have no psyche to help you, talent doesn't matter. And if you have the talent, then you can build the psyche. So the mind matters more. And I've had this argument before with a couple of followers of mine who tend to favor statistics, tend to favor that numbers can tell you everything. And I truly believe that of all sports, golf is the one that most cannot tell you through numbers what it's like to play it. Because in baseball, the reaction time isn't there to be able to psychologically freak out. You have half of a second to hit a 95-mile-per-hour fastball, if that. And you've got to make that decision to swing almost immediately, swing or take. In basketball, when you are playing, it becomes instinct to shoot the ball. You have good form or you don't, and you stand over, and if you feel like you've got the depth perception, all those things line up, you can do it. You know where you're good on the floor, you know where you're not, you know what your role is, and you do it in real time. Think about hockey. Hockey's a little bit more cerebral. You're trying to line up shots, but there are also moments of utter chaos where scoring happens, and you have to be able to work through that instinctively and find angles and ways to poke the biscuit in the basket that they're not really cerebral moments, you know. Think about soccer. Soccer is certainly a more psychological game. You're trying to set things up for later. You You try to create sets where you're trying to keep advantage of matchups, you're trying to run the field a certain way. That is a very psychological sport. Tennis, there's a psychology there, certainly, especially when you think about how pissed off so many of Roger Federer's opponents got last year when he crept up on the baseline on second serves and just old-schooled them, waiting for them to hit it 40 miles per hour or less and then hit it right back past them. So there's a psychological aspect there, but ultimately, that is reaction time. It is the confidence to hit the reaction, the shot with the right form at the right moment to put it where your opponent's not going to be able to get to it. But in golf, yes, the golf swing is a half second. But there is so much time between the shots, between the moments where you execute, that it is hard to escape those thoughts, escape bad thoughts. And when you get good thoughts, it's so easy to ride them. And then when one bad one creeps in, it becomes so much more difficult to push that out and execute, whether you have a great swing or a bad swing, just how you get back to the ball, because that ultimately is what matters. And then this kind of comes back to the numbers discussion, so I'm going to contradict myself a little bit here. But the TrackMan guys will tell you, look, ultimately what you got to be able to do is get the club back to square on the right path. It doesn't matter all the other crap that you do to get there. That's what you got to do. And it changes by body form. It changes by swing speed. Changes by club. It changes how you stand. All of those things. But at the end of the day, the moment of truth is when the blade gets back to the ball. Do you hit down on it with an iron and toward the target? And if you do those things, then it'll work. But if you say over the ball to yourself, there's no way this is going to work. The odds are it's not going to work. And I think that that's what makes golf so much more cerebral. It's why confidence, I believe, matters so much more in golf than any other sport, because you are deluding yourself every time on the tour. The best all-time winning percentage in the prime of their career was Tiger Woods. Jack Nicklaus is fairly close, but Tiger Woods, through the prime years of his career, including kind of through 2014, I think I did this data, he won a 29% clip. That is unheard of in golf. In baseball, they'll be batting 290, which is pretty darn close to 300, which is kind of that level where you go, if you're batting 300, you're a raging success as a hitter. In golf, if you are batting, for most people's careers, if you bat 1%, 1%, so 0.01, then you are an amazing player. You have been a success in terms of winning. If you have a long career. If you have a short career, obviously that's not so good. But if you have a long career and you win 1% of the time, then you have been tremendously successful. And if one of those just happens to be a major championship, then you've had a great career. So as a professional golfer, and as a golfer in general, you have to get to the idea and the comfort level of failure. Not success. It's easy to get comfortable with success. Too comfortable. You have to get used to the idea of failure. And maybe that's a metaphor for life. But Jordan Spieth is not going to win at this clip forever. He's going to have a slump. It's going to all level out. He has 7 wins, PGA Tour wins, and what amounts to almost 80 starts. He's winning about a 10% clip. And we think right now that's amazing. Because in the grand scheme, he's won 6 times in less than 2 PGA Tour seasons. So we go, oh, wow, that's amazing. That's a great clip. He's winning a 6 and 30 events, somewhere in that range. So probably, you know, he's winning 20% of the time. You go, oh, wow, that's incredible. What a great player. He's going to be such a force, an all-time great. And we've made that declaration after 30. And his confidence is riding sky high, and everything's going right. But realistically, he's won 10% of the time. And at best, if he continues this kind of run, ultimately that kind of will creep up toward 15%, maybe even 20% if he continues to go at this pace, and it all kind of levels out with the space of time. If you said he won 20% of the time, you'd be an all-time great. Easily. Easily an all-time great. And you have to get used to the idea that you screw up more often than you hit the shot you want, and that you need to know where you screw up, how to get better marginalizing those screw-ups so you give yourself a better chance of rectifying them or making sure they never happen in the first place. And that is the psychological battle of the game, where if you feel that you can do that, not only do you feel confident in executing the shots, but you feel like you can get yourself out of trouble when you get there, inevitably get there. And that when you come up short, it doesn't mean the end of the world. It just means you lost that day, and you're going to keep losing. But if you keep doing the right things, you're going to get there. Those are the guys that do the best. Those are the guys that hang on the longest. Those are the guys that have great careers. If you put too much pressure on yourself when it's going right or wrong to get it right, that's where you lose it. That's where you fall off the tour, and all of a sudden you just can't get it back, or you get it back, you're just a journeyman, and you have just enough confidence to be able to do this, but not enough to do well. And that's what I think I admire the most about great players, is that they have the confidence in what they've worked on, what they do inside the ropes, but they also have the confidence to live from defeat. You know, I almost think it would be a little easier. And if you're a journeyman PGA Tour player, feel free to call me and text me and tell me I'm an asshole. But I would think it's almost easier, and I think this is why there's this notion floated among kind of players that don't get the job done, that they would rather be a journeyman, or they'd rather be a guy that doesn't win all the time. They can just rake up the money and not care. That there is a kind of commitment you have to make psychologically, that you're willing to lay it on the line. You're willing to gamble to try to win, and if you lose, it won't break your heart. It won't shatter your mind. But if you're one of those guys that plays to make cuts and make a little bit of money, and you're just trying to hang on to your card, get in the playoffs, get a little bonus, and call it a season, that it's easier if you can do it just good enough. Obviously, if you don't have the right talent, you don't have the right mental makeup, and you just kind of float in between the web.com tour, the PGA tour, mini tours, all of those things, then you're not in this category. But if you're an established journeyman, if you're a guy who comes out and plays on the PGA tour 5, 6, 7 years and just wins $1 million, $1.2 million, $900,000 every year, 30 starts, you make $30,000 a start, you're just making cuts. And if you have a good Sunday, you make a good check, you make a six-figure check. If you have a bad Sunday, you still make 30, 40, 50 grand. That's fine. That's a grind, but it is not as psychologically difficult as trying to lay it out there and be the best in the world. And I think that's why guys settle for second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth. Because at the end of the day, it's still good money. You're still making a good life for yourself. And there are only so many slots on the Mount Rushmore of golf. In fact, the Rushmore has only changed once in the last 40 years, I would say. And that's for Tiger Woods. And everybody else is cast aside to some different area of consideration. So to believe that you can get there and to live through all of the pain that comes with not accomplishing your goals or your lofty goals, can you imagine what Tiger Woods is going through right now? We've talked about this on previous shows. Tiger is coming to grips with the fact that he is coming up short in his professional life of what he could have accomplished against Jack Nicklaus's record, against Sam Snead's record, just against expectations of his, of the world's. And that has to be a really difficult thing to deal with. And I know so many athletes go through it. You replay moments in your mind again and again. You go, if that didn't happen, everything could have changed. And for Woods, he has those. There are 5 or 6 different majors where if he had done just something a little bit different, he'd won them. He'd be at 19, 20 majors already. Everything that could have happened with his back. And I keep hitting in on Wai Yang and had a healthy debate on Twitter about it with folks. I said, well, maybe you're right. Maybe you're not. Maybe it was the revelations of the National Enquirer, the Thanksgiving night crash, all that stuff. Maybe that was the death knell. And maybe so. But if you kind of project down the line even further, certainly the elements of that night weigh heavier, because it instructs him to go try to play the Masters. That leads to a certain divorce. He plays okay, but he feels like he's got a Band-Aid swing, which made him sour on Hank Haney. He changes from Haney, so he loses 2010 and goes to Sean Foley. Foley puts him in a swing in a posture that is terrible for his back. A couple of years later, he manifests itself as a back injury. He has to have a microdiscectomy. Now he's going to go back to his old swing because it's the only thing he feels he can do anymore, which he can't physically. That leads to two more back surgeries. Now he's done. Whatever happens after this, he's done as a legitimate threat to get to 18 major championships. So for him, he's processing that moment. All of those moments where he could have won a major, or if he had done something a little bit differently with his personal life, then maybe he wouldn't have gone down the path professionally that he did, and he might not have been on an operating table three times in the last 21 months. It's a small margin. Small things add up to big things if you're a great player in golf. And that, if you understand the weight of that, and you can still continue to do that for as long as possible, that is what makes you great. Jordan Spieth is entering that category now, where he hasn't even picked the minds of the guys who have been number one in the world. Not to the extent that he could. And quite frankly, he shouldn't. Because they know the lessons of failure, either personal or professional, that influence them losing the edge. He doesn't know that yet. And frankly, the longer he can go without figuring that out or learning that, the better. Because it's going to be harder for him, hard for anybody that gets in that position, once they realize how small the edge is and how quickly you can lose it, that you kind of start to walk on eggshells and all of a sudden it's gone. So more power to Jordan Spieth for trying to figure out how to be a greater champion, and he's done that inside the ropes. Just focus on that. Don't focus on trying to be the number one guy. Don't do it your own way, and don't let other people influence you. And see where that takes you. And then when it goes south, and invariably it will, because unless he wins 25 majors, he's going to have a lull. Then you kind of go to your peers, the people who have been through this before, the ones that did it right, and try to figure out an answer for yourself. Then and only then, I think, do you do that in golf. That'll do it for us this week on the show. Hopefully you had a great time. I did. Sorry for the delay in putting together the show this week. Next week on the show, we'll talk a little bit about the Sony Open in Hawaii. Jimmy Walker's going through for a three-peat. We've got Vijay Singh, at least through the first round, at 52 years of age, almost 53, on the verge, not the verge, but on the top of the leaderboard with a chance to become the oldest PGA Tour winner in history. Well, if that's the outcome, then we'll certainly talk about that. And then we get into the European Tour, the real European Tour meat of the schedule as we get ready for the Middle East swing, and getting to see Jordan Spieth and Rory McIlroy go against each other should be very, very exciting. And in the not-too-distant future, in a couple weeks, we've got the LPGA Tour kicking back up, and here we go again. We're back into full schedule mode. If you would, if you love the show, please give us a 5-star review on iTunes if you listen to us that way. We always appreciate your comments and questions. You can also email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com, and you can check us out on our website, golfnewsnet.com. Also, be sure to check out betdsi.com. That's where we get our golf odds every week. So if you check out the odds making that we do in the fantasy projections, kind of based off of those odds, we get them this year from betdsi.com. And check them out when you have an opportunity. Until next week on the program, I'm Ryan Balaji saying thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week on the 19th Hole Golf Show.